Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of society. To those who know that the world's political, that the world's religious, that the world's military and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are in fact counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to know who is working against our interests, to understand how and why they are doing so. Because exposing and condemning such schemes, even if they are patriotic, even if they are militaristic, even if they are religious or political, isn't hateful. It is the most caring thing we can do. In our second hour today, we are going to have a discussion between Scott, who was the original producer of the Shattering Myths show, still works for GCN, and Aaron, who currently produces the Shattering Myths program, on a issue that came up in sports. It happens to cross over into the news and into moral discernment areas, and so we're going to talk about Winston, the quarterback of Florida State, who won the Heisman Trophy, as well as the national championship, and discuss the conditions surrounding the police investigation in Tallahassee, as well as the university's complicity and this whole sordid affair. It'll be an interesting discussion. And on our third hour, we're going to return to the prophetic passage in Yeshayah 18, where Yahweh explicitly condemns the United States of America. And we're going to see what he says will occur relative to the United States. If you are listening to this program and like to participate in this discussion, you are invited to do so. Our number is toll-free. It is 877-300-7645. I read an article yesterday. It was published by CBS News. And in attempting to explain the pagan past for Easter, it simply promotes a whole new set of lies. And since the world was celebrating Easter this past Sunday, yesterday, and since it was impossible to get away from, since it was so uniform, I mean, you couldn't even turn on a sports presentation without somebody talking about the celebration of Easter, that I thought we would use this CBS article as a foil to explain what's wrong with religion and the media. It begins, so there's a bunny who lays eggs, which kids are sometimes sent out to find or given a basket to eat. But what, many ask, does that have to do with the Christian holiday of Easter? Some of those holiday traditions can be traced back to Northern Europe. No, they can't. They're traced back to Northern Europe. They're traced back to Babylon. Babylon is where they were conceived. Easter was conceived in Babylon. Easter then went from, and its traditions, and the Mother of God and the Queen of Heaven and the earth becoming impregnated with the Son of the Sun and dying and resurrected deities. All of it was conceived in Babylon. It was usurped and copied into the Egyptian religion. It was embraced in the Greek religion. It was brought right into the Roman religion. It is an integral part of the Roman Catholic Church, and it was swallowed whole by Protestants when they thought that they were somehow disassociating themselves from Roman Catholics. That's what its origins are. It's not hard to find. In fact, it wouldn't take a journalist 10 minutes to find that the origins of Easter bunnies and Easter eggs and the name Easter itself, as well as the origins of everything that Christians celebrate on this day, including a dying and resurrected God, were first conceived in Babylon. And the distinction is important because Yahweh goes out of his way to tell us that if we want to have a relationship with him, we have to walk away from Babylon. He tells us that Babylon means corruption. It means confusion. He tells us that Babylon represents religious and political sin. He even tells us that the whore of Babylon is Satan. What more do you need to know? If only you knew the truth, to go where the words lead, and away from the pagan celebration that angers God, that has nothing to do with God, that is an abomination to God of Easter. The article says many European words for Easter actually find their roots in the Hebrew word Pesach, a clear connection to the Jewish Passover according to linguistic and religious sources. No, they don't. There is no word associated with Easter that is based upon Pesach. Not one. Pesach means to pass over. There's no linguistic association between Pesach and Easter. In fact, there's no even association between what Pesach represents and what Easter represents. They're never celebrated on the same day. Passover isn't Jewish. Passover is Yahweh's invitation to meet with Him. It is the doorway to life that has been provided by Yahweh. This association with Jewish is invalid. They go on to say, the English word Easter and the German version Ostern derive from Ostara, the name of a Germanic goddess, which in pagan traditions represented springtime, the morning, and the east. Ostara is not the basis of Easter. Ishtar is. Ishtar is the name that was given to Semiramis. You know, when you go through the various pagan derivatives, the satanic derivatives of the Babylonian religion, what you find is that the name of the chief of the gods, the father of the gods, the mother of the gods, the son of the sun, change. The basic premise of the religion stays fairly consistent through all of them, all the way through Roman Catholicism. The only difference is they give different names to the Son, to the Father, and to the Queen of Heaven and the Mother of God. That's really the only difference. Ishtar happens to be one of the names that was ascribed to Semiramis. Semiramis was a Babylonian king. Astarte was one of the names she was known as well. And Astarte, Semiramis, Ishtar, depending on what variation of the name you prefer, was the wife of, the queen of Nimrod. And when Nimrod died in a hunting accident, torn apart by a wild boar, rather than lose her authority, her power, and be swept aside, what typically happened is they were killed and buried along with their king, she claimed that she had been impregnated by the rays of the sun, and so that 9 months after Easter, she would give birth to the son of the sun, today's Christmas celebration. And by so doing, she was able to claim that she was the mother of God and the queen of heaven, akin to Orthodox and Catholic Christianity. They just give that name now to Mary. That is the origin of this. That is the name of the pagan goddess. It derives itself from Babylon. A New York Times piece, this article reads from CBS, from 1899, notes that for a faith looking to, quote, give Christian significance to all such observances as could not be thoroughly rooted out, it was far too much of a leap to prove a connection between joy at the arriving of the natural sun, which is the rising of Christ from the grave. This was a really troubled quote, but what they were trying to say is that back in 1899, the Christians began to recognize that every aspect of Easter was pagan. the hot cross buns, the Easter lamb, the 40 days of weeping for Tammuz, which is now called Lent, the Easter bunny, the dyed eggs, all of it. The time of year that it was celebrated, the fact that it was a Sunday celebration, every aspect of it was Babylonian. And so what Christians tried to do is the same thing that they do every time that you cite Yahweh's testimony to condemn their religion. They come up with an excuse. It's never an answer. It's never intelligence. It is simply another lie piled on top of a lie to help justify their lies. And this was very common, for example, in the early Christian church, whereby the fathers of the religion of Christianity would write, how fortuitous it is that the son of the son, this would be Mithras, was conceived on the same day that our Jesus was conceived. Now, they wouldn't use the term Jesus, as that Jesus was actually invented in the 17th century, but that was the interpretation. That, oh, it's just as a fortuitous thing that God ordained is that the Christian deity would be conceived on the same day that all pagan sons of sons were conceived. And that's what they're trying to say here, is that, wow, we can make a connection between the joy of the arising of the natural son with the rising of Christ from the grave. That was their justification. So take a pagan concept, which is that you attribute divinity to the rising sun, and now you apply that to your pagan interpretation of God, justifying it. These springtime festivals, the article read, also featured symbols of fertility, which carried into the Christian traditions surrounding Easter, hence the bunnies. Yes, the bunny has always been a symbol of fertility because it gives birth to so many offspring. And it does because in the food chain, it is food. And therefore, it reproduces rapidly because it has no mechanism for fending off predators other than rapid procreation. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. The subject is Easter. We're using a CBS article, which is probably 20% accurate, 80% inaccurate in terms of the origins of Easter. Well, Dave, it was interesting. I got a letter today from a person who claimed that they sent me an article. I didn't actually open the article, but Waleed Shabbat, who is an interesting fellow. Waleed Shabbat claims to have been a PLO terrorist and a Muslim, and that he left Islam and terrorism and followed his wife's urges to become a Roman Catholic. He is extremely bright. He speaks beautifully. I have met him in person, and we have shared many emails and telephone conversations. The article that he published is that those who advise against Easter are part of a cult. So rather than admit that Easter, as celebrated religiously in Christianity, is ascribing to the cult of the Babylonians, he is saying that anyone who speaks out against Easter is part of a cult. It's the typical religious response. Sad that this man, who is very bright, recognized the faults in the Islamic religion, but cannot find those same faults when it comes to Roman Catholicism. Moving on to the depiction here in the CBS article, it says that the springtime festivals also featured symbols of fertility, which carried over into the tradition surrounding Easter. Then there's this quote, the bunny thing is a spring and fertility rite, said Lizette Larson Miller, a professor with the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Boy, so you need a PhD to determine that. I think that any internet connection in about 3 minutes of time would make that information unequivocal. Bunnies are known for their fertility, so I suppose someone long ago put that connection together. Oh, there's a professor. Paid by Berkeley, Cal, University of California in Berkeley, to say that someone long ago, I suppose, put that connection together and she can't go back to Babylon, study the Babylonian religion. And it's not hard to do. She, after all, she's a professor in this stuff. The eggs, too, are considered a natural fertility symbol, but some Christians are also able to find in them something else, symbols of future life and, in a way, a resurrection. So, the means of coming from an egg to become a bird is a explanation of the non-existent resurrection. It's perfect. You're going from a material thing to a material thing, and that is resurrection. Now, at what point was the embryo in the egg dead, dear Christian? And why would you take a pagan fertility rite celebrated during Easter Sunday some 4,000 years ago and try to give it a religious gloss in your religion? You know how moronic that is? Anyway, going on with the story, they say that eggs don't just have a Christian significance. Now, this is an egg having a Christian significance. forget about the fact that, you know, an egg is can serve as food, but an egg is, you know, primarily the means that birds use and reptiles use to reproduce. So do fish. It's a natural part of the reproduction cycle. But now, even though this has a Babylonian significance religiously, now they have a Christian significance. But according to the New York Times piece, there are also references to the idea that Jews use eggs in Passover. Listen, there is no part of Passover described by Yahweh that mentions an egg. Not once. He does not mention eggs. He mentions lamb. He mentions fire to cook the lamb. He mentions unyeasted bread. He mentions bitter herbs. That's what he mentions. Nowhere in the context does he reference an egg. To blame the instructions regarding Passover for Christians embracing a pagan tradition is inexcusable. And it would just take, again, a moment's worth of research to read the Torah, the portions of the Torah pertaining to Pesach, to see that there's no reference to an egg. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Just a quick note during the entry to the last segment, I was talking with Aaron about a another issue which was a associated with the story we're going to do in the second hour, where there's an analogous issue with Ben Roethlisberger, the quarterback of the the Pittsburgh Steelers, where he lost game checks and lost the ability to play for a period of time because of an alleged issue of sexual misconduct in a bar. It happened to be in Georgia. And so I was pointing Aaron to that article so that he would have a comparison when we engage in that conversation about what the University of Florida State should have done in the case of Winston. So if you overheard that, and I did think it was broadcast in the air, that was the context of that discussion. Before we continue with the piece on Easter, we have Glenn, who has called in and has and kindly held through the break. My pleasure to welcome you back, Glenn. How are you?
Great. All right, thanks. I've been chafing it a bit to tell you about this.
Please.
Over the weekend, I had seen an interview on RT, Russia's state television, the Russian TV channel, yeah, and cable, on a program called Worlds Apart, hosted by Oksana Boyko, who is apparently RT's Islam expert. She had on as her guest a man named Robert Spencer.
Oh, my.
His website is jihadwatch.org.
Yes, I know Robert.
You would have loved watching this because you would have been sitting there cheering like you were watching your favorite football team score a touchdown. He just made mincemeat out of her. She kept trying to cast him in the role of someone who was defending, as if he were defending U.S. foreign policy in regard to, relations with Islamic countries and groups and stuff. And he would time and again say, well, yeah, I'm not here to defend U.S. foreign policy. I think this is a bad idea. That's a bad idea. He would agree with her and that sort of thing. And then she finally kind of started to get the idea. But then he also kept making the point and drilling home how the violence is inherent to the doctrine of Islam. And she kept trying to dance around the issues like Sunni versus Shia or moderates versus extremists. And he just hammered back with, like, historical example or geopolitical example or this. And his refutation of her was masterful. That Barty interview is viewable at jihadwatch.org. You just go there and click on the link, and you can watch the whole thing. He did an amazing job.
Well, it's encouraging. Over the past, I've had words with Robert Spencer, and most of it is over two issues. One is that his early writings, as he began his site, spoke of moderate Islam, and that his desire for moderate Islam to prevail over radical Islam. And a reader of Prophet of Doom communicated with him and said, you know, what are you talking about? There is no such thing as moderate Islam. There has never been such a thing as moderate Islam. There will never be such a thing as moderate Islam. There is only Islam, and Islam is inherently violent. And he, like most authors, had a conniption fit that he was being challenged. And this particular reader of Prophet of Doom cited me as proof that he was wrong. And Robert Spencer had a quadruple tizzy fit over that. And the irrational side of Robert Spencer came through in a series of emails that I later published for our readers' edification on the Prophet of Doom site. My hope is that Robert Spencer has come to realize, and maybe he has over time, that there is no such thing as moderate Islam.
I think I see the distinction. I know it. The difference would be made, and I think when he simply just watch the interview, he clearly makes the distinction, you know, between what is inherent and innate to Islamic theology and jurisprudence versus the attitudes of more nominalists, like what you would call bad Muslims. You know, he acknowledges that the vast majority of Muslims are bad Muslims because they want to be peaceful.
By the way, that's not true. Although that is better, that's more accurate than saying that there's such thing as moderate Islam.
Well, maybe not most, but I mean, the point is, he even references the Ahmadi sect, which are reviled as infidels to be killed by other Muslims. So,
if you look at the sects of Islam that would be but religiously inherently moderate, they represent less than 1% of the religion, so they're not even worth acknowledging.
I understand, but in terms of him making the point that people, in other words, the average religious adherent doesn't know much of anything about religion. There are plenty of Muslims out there who don't know about what's in the Hadith or even the Quran.
Right. And making that distinction is a fine distinction, so long as you don't infer that the religion has a moderate application, or that the religion can be viewed or interpreted moderately. The only way that you can be a peaceful Muslim, according to the Quran, is to cease to be a Muslim.
But now, he's aware of that, yeah.
Okay, and the other issue that I had with, and by the way, it's the majority of Muslims who favor jihadism every time a vote is taken in the Islamic world, every time. The preponderance of the population, usually at the tune between 65 and 70%, vote in favor of the most fundamentalist Islamic candidate, where jihad is an obligation in the religion. So it is a majority of Muslims who have become fundamentalists. The second issue that I had is that, I like to know the facts surrounding an issue, and then I like to hold people accountable. We got in quite a disagreement. He happens to be a Catholic. And we got into quite a disagreement over whether or not it is, he thinks it's anti-Semitic to say that had it not been for rabbis selling Muhammad quotations out of their Talmud, Islam would not exist today. So, and the fact is, according to the Quran, according to the Hadith, according to the only witness that we have of that time, the Quran and Hadith both acknowledge that rabbis in Yathrib sold Muhammad Talmud citations. And then they mocked him for bastardizing them, for twisting those Talmud citations to become part of his Quran. And that if it, those Talmud citations that Muhammad quoted is the entire basis of the Quran that gives it any religious credibility. When apart from those Talmud citations that Muhammad twisted, the Quran would be so laughably stupid that no one would have ever been beguiled by it. Now, that's a statement of fact. All you have to do is do your history. And so I said, you know, it's a shame that Jews did this.
Well,
because they have brought this, they have given credibility to their most ruthless enemy. And holding them accountable for that is something that Mr. Spencer had a conniption fit over, and it's a matter of fact.
All right, well, yeah, now it's a matter of speculation as to whether or not in their absence anyone would have been beguiled by it.
I don't think so.
Well, there are plenty of more existing notions floating around today by which people are
I can tell you, Glenn, that I appreciate your insights. You're usually extremely well-informed and extremely rational in your conclusions. I know a lot about the basis of Islam and what gives Islam any glimmer of credibility today. And I can tell you that had Muhammad not received these Talmud citations to give his Quran a religious gloss and a gloss of credibility, then there is no one out there that would be promoting the Quran today as the inspired word of God. It is the rest of the Quran is comprised of only two things. There's the never-ending argument between Muhammad and the Meccans, where the Meccans say, we know you, Muhammad, and you are a complete fraud. You are covetous. You want sex, power, and money. And everything you've said is a lie. And Muhammad responds by saying that my God is going to torture you forever in hell for making those statements. And then he moves to Yathrib. While his Quran then takes on this religious gloss, if you take the religious gloss, the bastardized Talmud stories away from it, all you have left is fight, kill, and steal. Nothing else. And so there isn't enough to give it religious credence, and it would be just a forever mocked book. In fact, the only citation that Westerners will ever cite from the Quran to show that the Quran is a great book is that if you were to take one life, it's as if you killed all of mankind. It happens to be from Quran 5:32. It precedes, of course, the most ruthless line in the Quran, which is 5:33, where Muhammad has his God say, those who belittle and besmirch Islam should be crucified. They should be killed. They should have an arm and a leg on opposite sides cut off. They should be incarcerated. It's just stunningly vicious. And, of course, the Westerners will never quote it in context and add the second line. But even the whole story that based upon if you kill one person, it's as if you killed all of mankind. It's a direct quote from the Talmud. There are whole chapters of the Quran that are directly from the Talmud. And so, yeah, that's the reality of the religion. And, the Jews who sold Muhammad those stories, they literally sold him. They made him pay for those stories, and then he used those stories to wipe out the Jews within camel ride of Yathrib and Mecca, enslaving their children, raping their women, and killing the men. He certainly perpetrated that religion based upon what he was able to do in terms of bastardizing those stories. It's the same thing true, by the way, with the first three quarters of the Quran chronologically. Muhammad plagiarized the Hanafis in Yemen, and almost everything that he says that sounds somewhat religious is plagiarized from them. He didn't have an original thought. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Rather than continuing on the Easter account, I would like to continue to discuss complicity with Glenn here. Glenn, I'd ask you a question. When businessmen in the United States financed and did business with Adolf Hitler before he was became Der Führer, and in essence financed his ability to have his own private army as a failed artist. That's pretty hard to do with the brown shirts, and to have the Nazi headquarters, and to be able to finance his campaign. Were those American businessmen therefore somewhat complicit in the deaths of the 55 million who died as a result of Adolf Hitler's rise to power?
Oh, yeah. No, look, I'm not in disagreement with you about accountability or complicity or any of that.
By the way, I'm not arguing with you here. What I'm doing is with the two of us, I want to make a point that we have to be accountable. Another example. Right. When American businesses, particularly the Fords, decided that they would build factories for in the Soviet Union. When those factories manufactured weapons that were used to kill American boys and girls in Vietnam, were Americans complicit in the death of their own children?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
When Zygmunt Brzezinski and Jimmy Carter came up with the harebrained idea that we could start a proxy war in Afghanistan, renting the Taliban from Pakistan and supplying them with weapons, was the United States and its political leaders complicit in the terrorism that was thereby later perpetrated by the Taliban and al-Qaeda against the United States?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But through the magic of selective enforcement, you know, law and logic don't come into it when you have an agenda.
That's correct. So most Americans are victims of propaganda. They don't investigate the history. They're unaware of the acts of others and the consequences of those acts. A great example would be when America invaded Iraq on what was proven to be a pile of lies, and removed Saddam Hussein from power, and unleashed a wave of terrorism in Iraq that is worse than any that has ever been seen anywhere in the world. Was America complicit in bringing such horrific terrorism to Iraq?
Oh, yeah, sure. And same thing with the Shah of Iran situation and everything.
Correct.
Mossadegh and the Shah of Iran and all that, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, we
Correct.
Do it time and again. You know?
Correct. And so it's there is something to be learned, something to be gained by us taking the time to study the facts and drawing reasonable, rational conclusions from those facts and holding people accountable for bad behavior, because there are consequences. You know, when the President of the United States speaks on behalf of Islam in the cradle of the Muslim Brotherhood and inspires Muslims to rise up in a Islamic reformation and to bring death to hundreds of thousands as a result, now the President of the United States should be held accountable for inspiring this carnage. And if we don't do that, then we're going to go off and we're going to be patriotic and we're going to be pro-military and we're going to say, respect the president and all of this sort of thing. And that's what gets the masses into trouble, blindly following propaganda.
Right. And, you know, it's just that there's, as you well know, that, you know, if you stand up and say that you don't see the emperor's new clothes, you know, sometimes there's a price to be paid, you know.
Of course.
Depends on how quickly you can persuade a large enough number of people to be protected or
right.
become another someone who takes a dive on the building.
Yeah, for example, there is nothing I have ever done that has brought more angst than exposing the fact that Islam is demonic, that Islam is inherently vicious, and that it's that Muslims haven't corrupted their religion has corrupted them. And second only to that is the 1,200 pages or so that I have marshaled against Paul, showing that Paul was demon possessed and insane, and spoke overtly against Yahweh's testimony. And when you do those kinds of things, you'll make a lot of enemies. The truth is extraordinarily unpopular, and no one wants to address the consequence of behavior of either religions or political institutions that they favor. So great call, Glenn. I appreciate your comments, and you've added once again to the content of the program. I appreciate you.